He shamelessly took advantage of his new position, and his wishes solely satisfied his ego. Tija's inner voice asked her if she now understood why Mender should have been left to the devastation of the surge. It had been intended that Tija would be the goddess, who lovingly would lead the lost people in the beautiful new kingdom. Her son, Jap, had inherited her ability of inner vision and was meant to succeed her. Through her misdirected compassion, she had now turned the energies in the wrong direction. The inner voice was very distressed, but Tija stubbornly insisted that her beloved husband certainly would rule the country in a good way. In addition, she was at his side, and she would help him lead all future projects. But soon Tija became aware that her voice did not count. Mender chose the most beautiful women at his court, and he lived a promiscuous life with them in luxury and abundance. Tija grieved, and her sons became more and more irritated at their father. Many moons had not shown their pale yellow rays when Tija was given the message to appear before her husband. He glared at her from top to bottom and complained that she had disturbed an important meeting the other day. In reality, she had surprised him when he was in bed with two women, and that had really upset her. Her inner voice had asked her to take the helm in the kingdom before things went the same way as they had in their previous homeland. Strengthened by the strict exhortation of her inner voice, Tija dared to reproach her husband for his loose living, and attract his attention on necessary measures required in the kingdom. Mender immediately commanded her to kneel in front of his throne. She obeyed out of love for her husband, unaware of his plans. Before she had time to ask him for an answer, the sword of the executioner fell down on her neck and separated her head from her body. Tija, who, like Noah, had brought an ark into port in order to save a part of the Earth's species, was sacrificed because she was a loving and defenseless woman. It was the first time the white man had removed the rightful owner from her lot by violence, the first time of many, many. Tija's children had been silent and horror-struck witnesses to what had occurred. Jap brought his sister and brother and escaped out into the woods and then up into the mountains, far away from their father's reign of terror. When they stopped at a clear and fresh mountain stream to quench their thirst, Jap heard his mother's voice loud and clear, "Walk straight ahead until you see a small hut. Enter the hut and greet politely the man sitting on the earthen floor. Tell him my name and then let him speak." The children did as their mother said, and sure enough, they arrived at a strange hut, built in front of a large cave. The man in the sun-yellow cloak greeted them with kindness and compassion and gave them plenty to eat. His name was Alon, and he was a very wise man. He lived hidden from Mender's dispatched men, because he knew that better times were to come. He loved his people but complained about their weakness and lack of courage. The children stayed with him for many lunar months, and he taught Jap a secret form of combat. He made Jap a warrior, not just any warrior, but a warrior of righteousness. When Jap was ready, Alon sent him back to his father. Mender was unprepared for the appearance of his son and immediately called for his guards. Jap just stood there, looking at his pitiful father. Mender's head started to nod and he looked as if he fell asleep, but he had a horrible expression on his face. Finally, he fell flat on the floor. He was dead. His evil power had been unable to resist Jap's good power. Those who witnessed this scene proclaimed Jap as his father's successor at once. The inhabitants in this kingdom were used to obeying someone, or it would be chaos. But Jap became a good leader for his people. He called for his sister and brother and Alon, and together this quartet governed the kingdom until it became a model for other countries. And you could say that it was Tija who indirectly accomplished this happy ending and that her mission was fulfilled after all. That's how this tale was told to me, and I think it is more interesting than Noah's Ark and so, I prefer to sing Mother Tija. Mother Tija was an honored wife. Translation note, rather than Old Man Noah was an honored man. Swedish song originally written by Carl Michael Bellman, this legend anyhow shows that the antagonism between the red and the white races started much earlier than we have imagined. At the same time, we shouldn't forget that Tija's children were a mixture of red and white, and that mixture resulted in a peaceful and loving outcome. 5. The Nine Elders of Sirius. Without me knowing it at that time, the nine elders had a great influence on my future destinies. They belong to the most ancient wisdom teachers and they were on Zio from the beginning. The nine elders are made up of both male and female teachers, and nowadays they reside on the central sun on Sirius, from where they go on occasional excursions to those planets where they are needed. Their names are not known on Earth because if they were, they would immediately be used in the wrong way by the power-seeking profiteers. The nine elders are only subordinate to one higher instance, the Great, Infinite Spirit. After the initiation that I did not pass, I wandered for a long time, sad and lonely. After the crossing when the ape man had murdered me, I was immediately hurled away to be born by an Earth woman. I had to go through a lot of tests and trials, because the nine elders followed my destinies until the day when I would be able to return to my brothers and sisters in the ethereal world. But it was a long way to go. Not until now have I arrived. In one of my earthly lives, I was privileged with the dubious pleasure of being born as the son of a ruler. In that life, I physically met one of the nine elders, a remarkable woman. We can call her Helia, since she appeared like a sun in a dark world. She was the one who is called Spider Woman by the Native Americans. According to their faith, she is the mother who weaves the web of life. It was Helia's task to create light and joy on Earth. Already at that time humans used their free will to subjugate the will of their neighbors. But Helia sent out love and true creative power, because the nine elders had decided to make a new attempt with the inhabitants of Earth. Helia succeeded in her task. Never have there been accomplished such brilliant buildings, never did humans have such good lives and were as strong and beautiful as when she held her hand over them. She sent out troops of light everywhere, and I was one of her faithful commanders. I remember her wrath and her grief when we failed to create lasting light somewhere. I remember when I and the other light bearers were sitting in ring with her, making plans. She was tremendously beautiful, but her beauty was not exciting. It was more like a calm lake in the forest, where you could refresh yourself. At the same time, her radiance gave power to all in her vicinity. Her knowledge and insight was an inexhaustible stream, and we were waves of that stream. But the hunters of power returned to Earth. The troops of light were crushed in order to make room for quite a different kind of warrior. Eventually Helia realized that she couldn't do anything more for her beloved Earth. Idols existed both inside and outside of the humans, and eventually she couldn't fight against them anymore. I myself had to inherit my father's throne after his death, and my task was to reign according to Helia's wishes. This lasted no longer than until my death. At the time of the destruction of Lemuria and Atlantis and the beginning of Egypt's prosperity, there was no more peace in the verdant land we had taken care of for such a long time with Helia. Neither the Great Spirit nor the Nine Elders could intervene in the work of their messenger. There were gods in other parts of the galaxy who sent complicated energies to Earth in order to get humans to submit to their will. For instance, Gododa. If humans had understood this better, the world would look different today. There was a weapon which the weak ones couldn't resist, fear. By means of it, the people became willing tools of power and still are today. The clergy, not the least, contributed to this, even before they were called priests. The ancient gods belong to history, that's what people believe. I remember from my last life on Earth that during parties with my author colleagues, we all raised our glasses and cried, "Still live the ancient gods." Cheers. We did not imagine how right we were, neither were we sober enough to think along such lines. But I will come back to the gods later on. They are of interest because they still exist, and moreover, they influence humans into being obedient toy soldiers. The reptile people. Without me realizing it, the nine elders have guided my lives for thousands of years. When I got to look back on my lives and what happened between them, I thought that it was quite messy. But I was wrong, because here is an incredible order and meaning behind everything. The journeys here in the Angels' School, when I penetrated into my former development, occurred in small doses because they were rather trying, even for a spirit. I got the opportunity to enter my own self during many periods of time and relive some difficult karmic events. Between my earthly incarnations, I often made galactic journeys, and they taught me a lot. I find it peculiar that it took such a long time, really until my last life on Earth, before I understood the connection between body, soul, spirit. My last death took me into the great cosmic system where I am now. I have met many of my own caliber here, not in the Angels' School but in the Palace of Light, not far from there. You can call the Palace of Light a kind of magnificent hotel, with guests from the whole world. These guests have very different backgrounds, but they all have one thing in common: they're light workers. They are angels who willingly travel to Earth or some other planet, bringing help where it is needed. You can call them invisible activists. I would like to tell you about an adventure I had between my Gen life and my previous earthly life. After having lived as a big swindler at the card table, where a well-aimed bullet ended the misery, I arrived at the usual foggy field, where I was fetched by a beautiful angel girl. I was fully aware of what sins I had committed, and since my mental activity still was limited, I took for granted that I would be sent off to some unpleasant place. But the angel girl smiled and told me that I would be sent out on an important mission. "Does card playing exist there?" I asked interestedly. But she moved her little hand back and forth in front of my eyes until I had completely forgotten what a rascal I had been. I looked down at my body and discovered that I was wearing a white, glittering gown. The angel took me through a great, shimmering light, and for a moment, dread passed over me. Who was I? Where was she taking me? I closed my eyes for a short moment, and when I opened them, I found myself in a beautiful garden. Strangely enough, I recognized the garden. A different kind of memory than the earthly one began to awaken in me. I had been here many times, in the Palace of Light on the ethereal plane. I sat down on a sofa and enjoyed the beauty of the scenery. From the position where I was sitting, you had a wonderful panoramic view. Close by there was a sea of flowers and far away, on the horizon, there was a real sea. I caught glimpses of red and white cliffs in the distance and lovely green forests. "Welcome back, Horace," said a friendly male voice. A tall man sat down at my side. He wore a pale yellow gold knitted cloak. He was in his 40s and had beautiful dark blue eyes and silvery white hair. Apparently, I have been called Horace, I thought, without remembering a thing from my previous life. "We have chosen you to carry out an important mission for us," the man continued. "Why me?" I asked, surprised. Of course, I was flattered, but something was telling me that I was not worthy of so much attention. "Don't imagine you were anyone special in your last life," he said and smiled. "Quite the opposite. You were a cheater and a daredevil, and it is the daredevil that we need. But all along inside the shell, there was a very good-hearted person. You took care of a poor woman who would have ended up on the streets if you hadn't helped her. She had a little son who was called an illegitimate child. But you always maintain that there are no illegitimate children. All children are legitimate small jewels in the forge of the great jeweler. You married that woman and had one more son and a daughter. Your way of providing for them was hazardous and dishonest, but the love for your family was deep and warm. When you had money, you helped everyone who asked you. When you were broke, you gave them a nice smile and exchanged a friendly word. That's why we have chosen you to carry out a mission on another planet." "Are there more inhabited planets than Earth?" I asked, astonished. "Oh yes, there are many. But this planet is located in our galaxy and is inhabited by the so-called reptile people. They have started to reconnoiter Earth, with a view to conquering it in the future. We absolutely don't want that to happen. That's why we need you." I was appalled. I could not by any means undertake such a mission. It would be better to send a diplomat who has kicked the bucket, I thought, and I said so. The man laughed. "You are chosen for this mission," he insisted, "but first you have to learn quite a lot." I was placed in the Angels' School. Since the memory of the characterless but kind fool I had been no longer remained in me, I managed to convince myself that the learning was easy and entertaining. I was not going to travel alone, I worked with a group of around 50 people. The guarantee for a successful mission was anchored in my hands. When it was time for departure, I had been developing both my inner and outer strength and I had been trained in different forms of protection. On trembling legs, I got up into the spaceship that would take us to the alien planet. When we landed, a group of reptilians was waiting for us. I was prepared for their appearance. We had seen pictures of them in school, but still, the reality was frightening. I saw that my fellow travelers reacted the same way, but now it was important not to show any fear. I walked up to the reptile man at the head. Imagine a crocodile standing upright and you get some idea of his height. His golden green shimmering skin was leather-like. His head was almost human, but far from attractive. His yellow-green eyes were slanted and elongated, with heavy, protruding, scaly eyelids resembling awnings. He had a broad mouth with thick lips, and his nose was short and wide, with large raised nostrils. None of the reptilians had hair, but some skulls were rounded in a human way. Others' heads were long and narrow, like the ancient Egyptians. "Hail in the name of love and light," I said, as I had been taught. "Welcome in the name of Dendra," was the quick answer, in a metallic tone. I knew that Dendra was the god that this strange people worshipped. "My name is Rock, and I will guide you to the palace," he added. "Our ruler, Merk, wants to see you at once, and you must be alone. But I am accompanied by a group of representatives from different worlds on our frequency," I objected. "If you don't want to arouse our ruler's anger, you come alone," was the answer. "Your friends will be taken care of in the best way, as long as they don't show any hostile attitude." Rock's expression was grim, and I felt threat vibrating in the air. The reptile people came nearer and formed a circle around my whole company. Swiftly I explained to my group that they had to wait for me. Then I followed the big reptile man across a bridge that led over a river that looked quite Earth-like. The color of the water was a bit different. It was transparent, but had a deep blue-green color which probably was ideal for camouflaging the reptilians. Rock turned around and smiled at me. "We dwell a lot in the water," he informed me. "It's good to be as invisible as possible if the enemy is near." I asked him who the enemy was, but I got no answer. Rock's broad, scaly back almost felt like a safety in this peculiar rocky landscape. Here and there were small patches of grass, but almost no other vegetation. Thick, thistle-like leaves covered the ground in a few places, and Rock broke off some of them and ate them with apparent delight. He made a sign to me to taste one, and I did so. The leaf actually had a nice taste. It contained a liquid that reminded me of honey. The palace was located in a cliff, and in front of it was an open space. I admitted unwillingly to myself that the front of the palace was exquisitely beautiful. It was hewn out of the reddish rock, and in the center was a huge doorway, decorated with gold and gems. Around it were very beautiful reliefs cut out. Also, the windows on both sides of the doorway had reliefs that probably represented the history of the reptile people. I would have liked to stay there and study this work of art more closely, but Rock waved impatiently at me to come along. At last I would meet this Merk, a meeting for which I had been prepared for a long time. We entered through several beautiful doors and saw reptilians hurrying around with various objects in their claw-like hands. The ceiling height was impressive, but the last door was low and made out of simple wood. Rock opened it and pushed me in. I was standing in front of Merk, the reptilian ruler. Many were the stories I had been told about him and his powerful planet. Many were the cosmic wars he had successfully fought. "Welcome," I heard him say, while my brain was registering both the usual and unusual surroundings. He was sitting at a sculptured table, on which a dinner was served. Imagine that reptile faces could be so different. There was actually something royal about this being, and his expression was almost jovial. He made a sign to me to sit down right opposite him. "You're from Earth, I presume?" he asked. "That is interesting for us. We haven't been visited often by Earth humans." "Well, I'm not exactly terrestrial any longer, I muttered. My mission is to ask you not to invade Earth. Humans must be allowed to develop at their own pace, and because they have free will, like you, they also must learn to use it properly. They cannot, if they are forced to be under your control. Threat creates fear, and fear solves no problems, but only makes them grow. It's not an Earth of problems you want, is it, with imprisoned humans who hate you and scoff at you? You are a wise messenger, Merc answered and smiled. Then I want to tell you that we have observed Earth for a long time and seen that it is a dying planet. It is rather a rescue action we have planned. Earth is certainly not dying, I protested. She is still beautiful and rich in natural resources. It is her inhabitants that have changed. I know, the ruler interrupted impatiently. Humans have, in a relatively short time, succeeded in ruining the Earth deep into the bedrock, in the same way as they have ruined themselves and each other with their free will. And things are getting worse in the future. If they had had a strong leader and strong laws to live by, this destruction would never have occurred. Nothing gets better by you taking the helm, I objected indignantly. Moreover, you would frighten people with your appearance, which differs so much from what we are used to. They would have to get used to us. We are not evil, young man. We are not going to kill you and eat you, he said laughing, but his eyes flashed in an odd way. We only want to teach you how to live in peace with each other and to respect the powers that be. We are a peace-loving people, even if we have sometimes been involved in conflicts originating from other parts of the cosmos. In addition, we are a creative people. You have seen what artistic heights we have achieved, haven't you? We can teach you to develop fantastic talents in various genres of art. We already have very nice art on Earth, I answered, and the Great Spirit asks you to renounce this project. If the Earth has not recovered and the humans have not changed in a positive way within the course of a couple of hundred years from now, the Great Spirit wants to discuss this with you again. He knows about your highly developed art and culture, but your whole planet is so mountainous that it is difficult for you to develop more without blasting away half of your planet. He suggests that you start to develop more from within instead. He is ready to send teachers here. Thanks, we don't need any, was the cold answer. We are not subordinate to the laws of the Great Spirit, but we try to listen to them if they are reasonable and if Dendru acknowledges them. We must pay attention to the wishes of our Godhead. In this case, he has given us an ultimatum. There are things we want to find out about humans, and we are going to do that. Since your delegation consists of humans that have developed on a higher level in the worlds of the Great Spirit, Dendra has a proposal for you. If we might keep your delegation here, we promise not to invade Earth now. You may return with this message. No evil will befall your friends, but we need them. This offer is irrevocable. I, Merc, ruler of the reptilian planet, have spoken. The door behind me opened. I bowed slightly to the ruler, who had returned to his meal. I couldn't reason this any further with him, and now I had the disagreeable task of presenting Merc's proposal to my delegation as gently as possible. When I did, there was a profound silence. My fellow travelers were sitting comfortably in a drawing room in the palace. They had received refreshments that looked appetizing, but tall guards stood at attention at the doors. There was no chance of escape. After a short while, one of my fellow travelers, who I all along thought looked nice and open, rose and spoke. Is there anyone who will report for duty voluntarily? He asked. We all have the power of returning to the worlds of the Great Spirit sooner or later. A whole Earth, where we have lived and loved, is in danger of being captured and perhaps changed in a negative way by the reptilians. What are our ethereal lives compared to the whole physical population of planet Earth? To be sure, we are already dead. We cannot die again. If we share our knowledge with this people, they may release us after some time. Then we have helped Mother Earth at the same as we have shared our ancient wisdom with the reptilians. This was a true man of honor talking. I embraced him and then asked all the others if they were prepared to stay. At first there was complete silence. After a while, one hand at a time was raised. Tears ran down my cheeks when Rock took me back to the waiting ship. "In the name of Dendra," he whispered in my ear, "I will make sure that no evil befalls your friends. I have a way with the ruler." It was sad, but good, tidings I took to the ethereal world. Apparently, the reptile people kept their promise. Yet, the snake-skinned humans have not invaded Mother Earth. But yet no one from my delegation has returned either. And Horus returned to Earth to be born as the farm boy January 6. In the Angels' School. I have been undergoing trial after trial even after my last life, since I experienced the Akashic Records and decided to stay in the ethereal world. The goal I have set up is demanding, and I still have a long way to go. But since time no longer counts, I have eternal life before me. And we continue with the teaching in the Angels' School. Sharlu informed me that the first trial was about longing, that is, longing back to Earth. If I felt it, the time was not ripe for me to proceed. Longing is such a common word on Earth. We are constantly longing to be somebody else, to conquer hearts, to make a lot of money, to travel to foreign countries, to be loved. We are always longing for someone or something, and on Earth longing can be creative. The Swedish poet Erik Axel Karlfeldt once wrote these lines: "Longing is the name of my heritage, the castle in the valleys of loss. My pretty teacher escorted me to a room in the Angels' School where I had never been before. The room was circular, just like a tower room." "It is a tower room," Sharla said, smiling. "Did not you notice that this house has towers with golden roofs? We all think it looks so nice." To my shame, I must admit that I had perhaps looked more at Sharla than at the school building. She read my thoughts as usual, started to laugh, and disappeared from the room with a sly expression on her face. After she had closed the door, it wasn't visible any longer. It had become one with the wall. It was important not to get claustrophobia. I sat down in an armchair in the middle of the room. It was a swivel chair. A pleasant bluish light made me think of a blue cupola. Suddenly it started to smell like spring, and a light breeze ran through the room. The formerly smooth walls showed a marvelous panorama. I swiveled around in my chair, and everywhere were glades of hepaticas and slopes of wood anemones on mossy ground covered with needles and cones. The wind rustled the trees fully audible, fir trees and birches, alders and rowans, all kinds of trees belonging to a solid Swedish mixed forest. I heard the babbling of a brook that, quite rightly, was flowing forward in a deep furrow close to an old, rounded, overgrown country road. Uprooted trees raised their animal-like, straggling shapes out of the moss and played with the imagination of the wanderer. I could feel this wonderful smell of spring, of damp soil, and of growing nature. I could see a bear watching me from his den and a fox running out of his burrow, with a tail of cubs close behind. The birds fed their cheeping nestlings, and a buzzard nestled high up in a pine crown. With his crown held high, the elk majestically strode along between the tree trunks, while the white rump of a deer flickered by through a thorn brake. I lived spring, I breathed spring from my swivel chair. Just as the longing for a Swedish spring morning in the forest had seized hold of my heart, the scene changed slowly, slowly. Fascinated, I followed how cowslip and bitter vetch, buttercup, saxifrage and clover, marguerite and forget-me-not budded and burst out in tender green grass tufts on the early summer meadow. I experienced the scents which go with the midsummer, with the high summer and haymaking, with flowers, weeds, sun, and rain. I was in the middle of it all, enjoying it and longing for it. When the summer around me faded and the leaves were colored in gold and red, I felt my pulse quicken. I have always loved the early autumn with its clear air and plentiful sunshine, glisteningly spread in the damp golden red. Never can you behold the nuances of a bright red maple leaf, so beautifully designed and delicately veined as on a sunny autumn day. My enjoyment was disturbed by a quiet snowfall. Big snowflakes fell on all the red and covered the ground in shimmering white drifts. A kick sledge stood leaned against the corner of a house and a couple of skis were ready to be used with their poles stuck into the soft snow. I followed the seasons and I enjoyed it all along. I longed for everything I saw.